Well, good morning. I have been very blessed this morning. I love those songs that you picked, Jim. And Brian, your children's lesson actually goes along very well with what I'm going to be speaking on this morning. It's amazing how God often does that in a service. And I'm excited to dig back into this. It's been quite a while. I think it's actually March since I preached last, and I've been totally fine with that, but it is interesting to get back into the series that we've been doing. And for those of you that weren't here, haven't been here, we're doing a series. It's called The Big Story, and it's how God worked in history through, mostly through the main characters of the Bible. But the reason for doing this is kind of two parts to it. I think one of them, for me anyway, was to just better understand the Bible as a whole, looking at it as a whole story, instead of just a bunch of individual stories or characters or teachings. It's a complete story, and it's God's story. And then also to get a better understanding of who God is, just by looking at how he's worked in the past. And I think it's easy to look at the stories in the Bible and look at the individuals involved in that and say that's the main character of that story, when really it's God who is the main character of every story in the Bible. So if we look at it as a whole, it helps us to better understand that, I think. So that's kind of what we're doing. Feels like maybe a little bit overambitious goal to try to go through the whole story of God in the Bible, but kind of looking at the main events, the main characters, and right now we're in Exodus. Last time we looked at Exodus 1 and 2, and following the kind of the timeline of the children of Israel. And last time we looked at how the children of Israel were in Egypt, and the government of Egypt kind of got freaked out by how big the children of Israel were getting. They were growing tremendously fast. And so the government kind of freaks out and decides to enslave them, turn them into their slaves, and also tries to kill their baby boys. And during this time is when Moses is born, and God miraculously saves him. And we know the story there. He becomes a prince of Egypt, and according to Josephus, one of the Jewish historians of that wrote about this time, it was actually fairly certain that he was going to become the next pharaoh. He was kind of on track to become that. He had had the best training on leadership, and he had actually, there's some records of him actually leading armies into battle, and likely was on track to become the next pharaoh. Well, and this is where we're going to pick up here. Chapter 3. But before that, we know that everything kind of goes south for Moses. He kills a man, ends up having to run for his life, ends up in Midian in the desert, and kind of teams up with Jethro there, meets Zipporah, and is married to her. And verse 1 is where we'll pick up in chapter 3. So if you want to turn to Exodus 3, verse 1. It says, "Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God." Now, nothing that significant in that verse, but if you were to jump one verse before that into chapter 2, it says, "And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew." Between that verse and the next one, there's a 40-year gap. I never made the connection there quite, but we know this because if you go to Exodus 7, verse 7, it says that Moses was 80 years old when he starts this quest that God puts him on to save the children of Israel. So there's a gap of 40 years there between Moses running from Egypt and where God meets him here. We don't know this for sure because there's not much that is said about what Moses was doing during that 40 years, but I think it's probably fairly safe to assume that he was doing the same thing he was when God meets him. So he's chasing sheep around a desert for 40 years. And he was married, and talks about him having a son. So I don't know what his life was like, but just imagine what it would be like going from probably one of the most important people in Egypt to a shepherd in a desert. And to us, it looks like that's a wasted life. I mean, he had the potential to be a great leader. He had the potential to maybe save the children of Israel, not knowing what happens later. But it looks like that's all over with. I mean, he's running for his life. He'll probably never be able to go back, probably never even be able to see his family again. Like, life is over for him, pretty much, in terms of what he could have done. But everything's about to change, and we don't know the whole story. Without knowing the whole story, it looks like it's pretty much over. But two things that I found really interesting as I was studying this, just kind of some side notes. It seems like this often happens in stories, in the Old Testament especially, but there's repetition of numbers. And for Moses, it was 40 years. For some reason, that was repeated three times. So Moses was in Egypt for 40 years, being trained to be a leader there, a prince. The next 40 years, he's in Midian, chasing sheep around. And the next 40 years, he's leading the children of Israel out of Egypt and leading them around the desert. So there's 40 years, 40 years, and 40 years. Found that kind of interesting. And then also, verse 1 there, it says that he came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And I'd never made this connection before, but that is actually the same mountain that is referred to as Mount Sinai later. The reason it's called Mount Horeb versus Mount Sinai is he was on the west side of the mountain when God meets him at the burning bush. On the east side was referred to as Mount Sinai, where the Ten Commandments are given. So it all starts at Mount Sinai, basically, where God comes to him and shares the plan that he has for him. And it all, in some ways, kind of ends up back there where he meets again with the whole children of Israel and gives them the Ten Commandments. Just some kind of interesting side notes. I love to see how God does that over and over. We saw that in Joseph, too. It was 7 years. He just repeats that. Anyway, so keeping on in chapter 3 here, I'm going to read verse 2 and 3. And I think just because of the length of this account that we're going to be looking at, I'm just going to kind of break it down into verses instead of reading the whole thing, so hopefully we can keep some continuity going here. But verse 2 and 3, it says, "The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned." Sometimes I find it a little humorous how our English translations kind of understate stuff. I don't know if it's a translation thing or if that's just actually how it's written in Hebrew, but so Moses is walking along and he sees a fire shooting out of a bush, and his response is, "I will turn aside and see this great thing." Now, I can imagine that it was probably a little bit more excited than that. Like, if you saw fire shooting out of a bush, you probably wouldn't be like, maybe I'll turn aside and see what this thing is. Probably a little less calculated than that. But maybe Moses didn't get very excited about stuff. I don't know. Maybe trudging around in a desert for 40 years did something to him. But verse 2, it says, the angel of the Lord appeared to him. And growing up, I don't know if I ever really noticed that phrase. I guess I just kind of assumed that God was making himself manifest in the bush, kind of a form of him. But it specifically says that it was the angel of the Lord, and that phrase is repeated numbers of times in the Old Testament. And it's a little bit confusing because I'm not exactly sure what that is. There's different interpretations of it. Two that I found interesting that I thought I would put out for you to consider is, one is a pretty literal view that God just simply sent an angel, and God was speaking through that angel. So the angel was just repeating what God had told to this angel to say to him, and the fire was just a way to get his attention. That was one just kind of simple interpretation. The other one I thought was a little bit more interesting and tied in with what we've been studying in John. And that is simply that what is referred to as the angel of God was actually Jesus, or the Word, Logos. So it was an embodiment of Jesus in the fire there in the bush. The burning bush would have been kind of a representation of Jesus as the Word of God. And it's kind of a little bit of an abstract thought, and the whole idea of the Word of God being Jesus that we looked at there in John is still, I'm trying to wrap my brain around what that is. But we could probably go into down a rabbit trail on this, but it's something to think about, I guess. The Word of God is what was speaking. It was the words that were speaking to Moses in this case. And Logos is what is referred to as the words of God, and that's also referred to as Jesus. So that's one, and I guess Logos is actually used in this. I mean, it was in the New Testament, it's Greek, and here it's Hebrew, so it's not quite a direct translation. But the equivalent, I guess, it would have been translated into Greek as Logos if you were to look at the word that was used there. So could it have been that Jesus was actually involved in this or was appearing to Moses? I think it would make sense, but just something to consider, I guess. It kind of adds another layer to the thought there. And there's a lot of stuff we could look at in terms of what that represents, how that Jesus is our deliverer, he delivered us from sin, he's the one that's coming to Moses and telling him to be the deliverer for the children of Israel, leading them out. There's so many layers to this that I just simply didn't have time to dig into and kind of expound, but I guess I'll just say this, everything points back to Jesus. That's what we see in the Old Testament, in all the stories, everything points to Jesus. I'm just going to keep reading here, verse 4 through 10. And we'll look at what God actually says to Moses here. So verse 4, it says, "When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, 'Moses, Moses.' And he said, 'Here I am.' Then he said, 'Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground.' And he said, 'I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob.' And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, 'I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings. And I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt.'" I'm going to pause there for now. So going back to chapter 2, verse 25, I love that verse. "And God saw the people of Israel, and God knew." This section of God speaking to Moses is just a powerful confirmation of that. God lays out exactly what's been happening to the children of Israel, and maybe Moses didn't even know that for sure. I don't know if he really had contact with his relatives or not. And this might not seem that significant to us because, I mean, obviously we know that God was watching because we know the rest of the story. But if you had been an Israelite in Egypt for 400 years, do you think you might have been wondering if God actually was keeping his promise that he made to Abraham, that he was going to make them into a great nation and give them a land? You know, we can read this in a minute or in a couple of minutes, and it's all compressed into that time. But if you had lived through that, and you had not just lived through it your whole life, but your father had and your grandfather had, and you heard the stories, do you think maybe God had forgotten about you and you hadn't heard from God at all during this time? So I guess it makes sense why God would just reaffirm that to Moses, because maybe he had even forgotten about that. And there's some evidence that maybe that was the case later on that we'll look at. But it's possible that the children of Israel had forgotten. It's possible that Moses had almost forgotten what that promise that God had made, or maybe even what God this was. The The one thing I thought was really interesting in this passage or in this section here is that it's an opportunity for us to look at the character of God. And that doesn't happen real often where God just directly speaks to somebody and explains who he is. But this section and then the following parts are really a really wonderful look at who God is. And the first thing we see here is that God is holy. And we know this, but do we understand how holy God actually is and how unholy we are? And we can see this in God asking Moses to just remove his sandals. Think about what would have been on the bottom of his sandals, you know, leading sheep around. There's a representation there that God does not want anything impure in his presence. And so the first thing he does is ask him to take off his sandals. And the second thing he does is ask him not to get too close. And that's a little bit of a foreign concept to us because we live in the new covenant where we can draw close to God. We have something that for thousands of years, the people that wanted to draw close to God couldn't because there was that barrier there of holiness or lack of holiness that they had. Several speakers that I was listening to on this passage compared God to the sun. You know, the sun makes us warm. It gives us light. It provides energy for plants. It gives us food, and we like it. I mean, we generally like it when the sun is out. But if you jump in a space shuttle, you back your space shuttle out of your garage that you probably all have, and you fly out of the atmosphere just far enough to where you don't have that protection of the atmosphere, and you step outside your space shuttle, what's going to happen to you? In a very quick amount of time, you're going to be burned to a crisp. And if you fly closer, at some point, your whole space shuttle is going to melt down, and you with it. And I think that's a good example of what happens, or what would have happened to Moses if he would have just run into that, closer to that bush. And even why the whole thing with the separation at the temple or the tabernacle, why there had to be that separation between God and the people. When something unholy, which we all are, comes into contact with something as holy as God and as powerful as God, we're going to melt. And we see that again here in God kind of warning Moses not to come too close to him. He says, do not come near. I think it should, although we have we live in an amazing time where we can draw close to God, we can come to him in prayer, we can feel his presence close to us and not have that fear of being burned up, there still needs to be that reverence, and we'll look at that a little bit more later, I think. But so that was one of the things that I gather from this. The character of God, the holiness of God, and the majesty of him is something that we shouldn't take lightly. When God comes and speaks to you, that's a serious thing. When you hear from God, and even when you hear from him through his word, because his word is who he is, that is a powerful thing and not something to just be taken lightly. Continuing on here, so the last verse that we read there, verse 10, it says, "Come and I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." And I'm going to keep reading here, verse 11. It says, "But Moses said to God, 'Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?'" So God clearly states what he wants him to do. And he doesn't even say, "You have to go do it." He says, "I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." So what is the first thing that Moses does? Well, if you think about it, you know, he was being prepared for this in Egypt. Or it looks to us, if we had been there, that God was preparing him to do this thing, to be a great leader, by the time that he spent as a prince in Egypt. So why wouldn't he just jump on this and be like, "Yeah, okay, here's my chance"? Well, you have to remember those 40 years of wandering around, having no connection with people, and basically being a wanted man, a chaste man, maybe. first thing that Moses does is object to it. And I think this is maybe somewhat of an indication of how we as humans are, and I think I would have probably done the same thing. His response is so much like what probably any one of us would have done in this situation, maybe. We think that God's universe revolves around us. And so if we think we can't do something, that's going to make or break the situation. We forget that God is the one still in charge of this whole thing. And if he wants me to do something, he will give me what I need to be able to do it. But we see in Moses' response here that he doesn't think that he can do this, so the plan's off. God's going to have to find somebody else. Or he's going to have to do it some other way. And here's the God that created him, that put all this stuff into place to do exactly what he wanted to with Moses. And yet he says, no, I don't think I'm the one for you. I can't do this. I'm not, who am I to do this? And that's interesting to look at, just because it shows us maybe our kind of what our attitudes are toward God sometimes. But I think God's response to this is even more fascinating. If you look at verse 12, he said, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. So the first thing, basically the first thing that God says has nothing to do with the objection that Moses gives. God doesn't say, oh, Moses, you know, you're a wonderful person, and I think you can do this. I believe in you, and I think you can do what I'm asking you to do. He doesn't say any of that stuff. He doesn't even acknowledge that he doesn't think he's adequate. He doesn't even address that at all. He just says, but I am with you. I am the one that's going to be doing this thing. And that's it. He doesn't even go into any of the... He doesn't even address the fact that he's not adequate, because that doesn't matter to God. Moses' objection to who he is doesn't even warrant a mention from God. And that's some powerful stuff, because I think for us, it's more the promises that God has written in his word, maybe, that we forget, that he will always be with us. For us, it's not just a specific mission that God has given us. Maybe it is sometimes a specific mission that God has given you, that you know God is asking you to do. But just as a whole in life, God has given us promises in his word, and has given us things to do from his word, especially in the Old Testament or in the New Testament, the teachings of Jesus. Think of the Sermon on the Mount, the teachings of Paul, stuff that is hard to do, that we don't want to do on our own, and we think it doesn't make sense to us to do it. And yet God has told us that he will always be with us. He will give us the power to do that. And we have the Holy Spirit that at that point the followers of God didn't even have yet. I think we make it so much about ourselves and our abilities and our experiences from the past and all that, instead of just recognizing that if God said that he wants me to do this thing, then he will figure out how to make it happen, even if I don't think I have the strength to do that. And we'll see that repeated over. Objection number two that Moses gives, a little bit more of a question, maybe wouldn't have to necessarily be considered an objection, but I think it was kind of in that, from that angle, verse 13 through 15. Moses says, then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Now, I mentioned this a little bit before, but this may be somewhat of an indication again that Moses and maybe the rest of the children of Israel had kind of forgotten who this God actually was. They were surrounded by many other gods from Egypt, and gods with a lowercase g. And it almost seems like, and some of the commentaries I wrote think that this might be the case, that Moses was actually almost asking God, so which of those gods are you? And I don't know if that's for sure, because Jethro was a priest, and it almost seems like he was a priest of the true God. So maybe he did know who he was talking to for sure. But for sure, when he was going to the children of Israel, I think it's likely that he was asking, what should we call you so that I know how to identify you to them? And the answer that God gives there, I guess I always thought of it as a little bit cryptic and didn't really make a whole lot of sense. It didn't seem that helpful until you dig into it a little bit deeper, and then it becomes really clear why God answers like that. I think, so looking at the, is it verse 14? God said to Moses, I am who I am. God makes it pretty clear to Moses right away that he is not like the other gods. He's on a different level. He just is who he is. And there's, if you look at the actual term for that, it's more of a verb than just being. It's actually like to be, or I am active. I am who I am all the time, and I have been in the past, and I will be in the future, and I am right now. It's kind of the essence of the word, I guess, that's used there. The thing that I found really interesting is when Moses asked God for his name, he was probably asking for kind of a description of him. And the reason for that is in Egypt, there were many gods, and the gods that were there had names that kind of described the character of that god. So, for example, like the god Ra meant the swift, or the god Ammon meant like the concealed one. And so in Moses asking God what his name was, he was also asking him, like, what's your character, or how should we describe you? And so God just giving him a name that kind of describes him was not enough, because God is everything. I mean, he's more than just what we can describe with human words. And so God just saying, I am who I am, is in essence saying, I can't be described with just a simple adjective or a simple name like you want to give me. And then he goes back and reminds him of the fact that he's been the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. So for Moses, or for God to give himself just a common name, would have brought him down onto the level of the other gods that were around him. And so God doesn't do that. And that just kind of opened my mind to the majesty that God, of who God is, I guess. God will not be compared with the gods that we set up around us. And God won't even be compared to the best descriptions that we want to come up with him, because he is so much more than that, and we don't even know how much more he is than that. And it's on us to continue to discover that. But I think this gives us a little bit of a clue as to how much greater he is than us. I think so often we want to make God into a better version of ourselves, or a really amazing version of who we are, just a perfect version of who we are. And that's, God's on a completely different level. He's not equal to us. He's not a better version, but equal. He's completely other than us. And maybe that's intimidating to think about, having a relationship with somebody like that, but the fact that he still loves us and wants that should only humble us and make us want to come to him, I think. Even though there is that separation of holiness, there is that intermediary of Jesus that lets us come near to him. Verse 16 through 22, I think maybe... I won't read that, because it's basically a repeat of what God says to start with. Moses basically, we already looked at that, Moses asking what he should say to the children of Israel, and so God explains that I am who I am, and then he also repeats again what he is planning to do with the children of Israel, and in terms of bringing them out of Egypt and making them a great nation, giving them a land that's flowing with milk and honey. We see that through verse 22, 16 through 22. And I love the especially verse 21 and 22, how specific God gets there. I'm just going to read those verses. It says, "And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and when you go, you shall not go empty. But each woman will ask of her neighbor and any woman who lives in her house for silver and gold jewelry and for clothing. You shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, so you shall plunder the Egyptians." It's very specific right here, and this is what Moses is supposed to repeat to them. And we'll see later how God actually fulfills that promise. So God tells Moses to, again, repeat this to the children of Israel. So what does Moses do? First thing he does is come back with another objection. Chapter 4, verse 1, "Then Moses answered, 'But behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice, for they will say, the Lord did not appear to you.'" And what I find interesting is that Moses right away tries to bring it back to himself. He tries to bring the discussion back to, well, what about me? If they don't believe me, then what? As though that's what's important here. And I'm not saying this to be judgmental of Moses, because I do the same thing. When I pray, it's all about me. If there's problems that come up, it's like, woe is me. What's going to happen to me? We do that so often. We forget that there is something so much greater than me and us. And I love God's response here again. This is verse 2 and 3. "The Lord said to him, 'What is that in your hand?' He said, 'A staff.' And he said, 'Throw it on the ground.' So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, 'Put out your hand and catch it by the tail.' So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand." And just like the first objection, God doesn't even acknowledge the fact that what he said is probably true. Maybe they won't believe him, or could be true. In this case, it wasn't, because God had already been working. He doesn't even acknowledge that Moses might face rejection. He just goes straight to, okay, I'm going to show you who I am. And so he tells him to throw down his staff. And I can just imagine, like, if you could go back in time and be kind of a distance and watching this whole thing take place. I don't know, it just struck me as funny to be thinking of Moses talking to a burning bush. All of a sudden he throws down a staff, turns into a snake, and he just takes off running. Somehow that just struck me as funny to think about, like, you're talking to God, he tells you to do something, and then all of a sudden you just take off running because you're terrified of what you see. It doesn't say how long of a time period elapses between that, where he takes off running, and the next part, but I'll read verse 5 through 9. It says, "And that they may believe that the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you." Again, the Lord said to him, "Put out your hand and..." I'm getting ahead of myself here. Verse 4. "So he threw it on the ground, it became a serpent, and Moses ran from it. But the Lord said to Moses, 'Put out your hand and catch it by the tail.' So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand." So it doesn't say how much of a time period elapsed between verse 3 and 4 there, where Moses is running and then he picks up the snake again. I can't imagine he's just like taking off running and then God says, "Pick it up by the tail." And so he's like, okay, and then he grabs it by the tail. I'm guessing there was a time lapse in between there of actually doing that. One commentator read that normally when you pick up a snake, you do it by the head so it doesn't bite you. But God specifically tells them to pick it up by the tail, and it immediately turns into a staff. So just instead of recognizing what Moses even said, the objection that he gave, he just simply shows him his power by doing this miracle. And then we see another sign where God tells Moses to put his hand inside his cloak, turns into leprosy on his hand, puts it back in, and it turns, leprosy is cleansed. And so we get all done with that, and then we get to verse 10. And Moses said to the Lord, O my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and tongue. Now, we read this and it's a quick thing, but can you imagine God going back and forth with Moses here? God showing him all these signs. He's appearing to him in a burning bush, and Moses just will not stop with the objections here. He just does not want to do what God is asking him to do. And I always thought that, I always questioned, like, okay, so later on here it says, that's the next section. So he's saying that he can't speak eloquently. And I think we're detecting a bit of a pattern here. God brings the discussion right back to himself in the reply that he gives to him. It says, Then the Lord said to him, Who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now therefore go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall speak. So again, he doesn't even acknowledge the objection. He doesn't say, oh no, you are actually a pretty good speaker, it's fine. He just simply says, but I made your mouth. I'm the one that can give you the words. And then Moses comes back with another objection. He says, oh my Lord, please send somebody else. He doesn't even really have an objection. He just says, please send somebody else. I don't want to do this thing. And then verse 14, then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses, and he said, Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he can speak well. Behold, he is coming out to meet you, and when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. I always read that thinking, okay, so God's getting angry with Moses for not wanting to do something. Seems a little bit like strange that God would just that quickly get angry. But when you think about how back and forth this has been and the signs that he's given him, I think I would be a little frustrated too. And the response that God gives in one way looks very gracious, like, okay, fine, I will send Aaron, your brother. But on the other hand, I was thinking about what it would be like we'll just use the example of, let's say your mom asks you to do something, and you're like, well, you know, I'm really busy, and I don't know, I just don't think I can quite get to that. And she says, okay, fine, I know your older brother can do it, he's pretty good at it, I'll just ask him to do it. Like, wouldn't that kind of sting a little bit? And you'd be like, well, okay, fine, I don't know if that's what God was doing here, but it specifically says that God was angry with him, and then he says this. And I don't want to put something on God that's not what he intended, but I think it's interesting that it says that right after it says that God's anger was kindled against him. And then he says, okay, fine, your brother is good at it. I'll have him be the one that speaks. And the reason I say that is because later, when the priesthood was set up, if you think about it, it should have really been, it would make sense that Moses would have been the head of the priesthood because he was the one that God sent to be the deliverer. He was the intercessor between the children of Israel and God. He was the one that received the Ten Commandments. It would make sense that Moses would be the head of the priesthood, but it was actually Aaron that ended up being the priesthood, or the head of the priesthood, and it was his descendants that would be the priests going forward. So I think Moses probably missed out on a tremendous blessing there, and the honor that would have gone with that to have him and his descendants be the priests going forward. And I think he missed that because he didn't want to do what God asked him to do. Now, God still used him. God still fulfilled his plan, but he missed out on a tremendous blessing there by not just saying yes to God. I think there's a lesson there for us that when there is something that we don't want to do, we know God is asking us to do, maybe it's just a simple command in Scripture that we're convicted to follow and we don't really want to, or maybe it's a specific task or a mission that God is sending you on or asking you to do. God is very gracious with us, and he won't just strike us dead if we don't do that thing, but we probably will miss out on a pretty tremendous blessing by not doing that thing. And that's our own fault. That's our own thing that we're missing out on. And I think there's so many examples of this in Scripture where if someone would have just said yes to God, they would have either saved themselves a lot of grief or would have had a tremendous blessing that they didn't receive otherwise. And there's a lot more I'm sure we could look at in that, but just a couple more kind of spiritual lessons I wanted to that kind of impressed me as I was studying this. And I know this is kind of a little bit all over the place, and there's lots of lessons we could learn in this, but kind of three main ones that I'll leave with you. Number one was that God doesn't very often send kind of a strange physical sign to us now, like a burning bush or some phenomenon in nature or whatever. Doesn't very often do that. I think there's still accounts of that happening here and there, but especially here in our country, we don't hear much of that or see much of that. But in your life, sometimes sooner or later, you're going to kind of get hit upside the head with something that completely happens out of the blue that just kind of knocks you sideways, a really tough situation, or you know, maybe it's a death of a loved one, or financial hardship, or health issue, something like that that's going to hit you, or even just a church split or a church issue, something like that. And it's easy to focus on that event and say, how could I have avoided it? How could I have responded to it better? Like, how could we make so this never happens again? We look at the event and keep our focus there. And I'm not saying that that's wrong. There's probably a lot of things we could learn from looking at events that happen. But I think sometimes God is using those kind of events to get our attention, just like God used a burning bush to get Moses' attention, because it makes us stop and reevaluate where we're at in life. When you're faced with something super hard, you're either going to walk away from God or you're going to walk toward God. And I hope that all of you will walk toward God when something like that happens to you. But it's kind of a reset button on our relationship with God and maybe even where we're going in life. For Moses, it was a complete 180 direction back to Egypt and a complete change of what God had in store for him or his plan for his life. And for you, it may be the same thing. It might mean a complete 180 on where you're going and what you're doing, and a wake-up call, and just an opening of your eyes to something that you had never seen before. So maybe when something like that hits you and it's completely unexpected and out of the blue, I don't think we always have to be like, oh, God has something completely different for me. I need to pack up and move to Canada or something. But it might mean that. Just be open to God and ask him what that means for you. Sam's cheering back here. If it means moving to Canada. And even over the weekend, I was talking with Brian some about this, how that sometimes God will... You think you need to go somewhere or do something different, but it's not clear what that thing is yet. And so instead of just forcing your way through, sometimes it is best to just have patience and wait, and then God reveals himself what he wants you to do in that time. So I don't know what the answer is in terms of like just go do something or have patience. I think you need to be sensitive to the Holy Spirit in that. But those big events in your life, those hard events, can sometimes be the thing that makes us reevaluate where we're going, like it was for Moses here. Second lesson is that I kind of took away from this is if you find yourself in the middle of a really tough situation that doesn't make sense, maybe a little bit like the Israelites found themselves in, it's not because God has forgotten you. God does not forget and he does not leave us. And even when God is silent for a period of time, he has a reason for that too. And I think each one of us that have faced tough situations, which I'm sure we all have, we can look back on those times and say, God didn't seem very present, or it didn't really make sense what was going on, and yet, now that I look back on that thing, I see that God was working the whole time and that he did have a plan and all of that. And it's easier to do that looking back, but it's harder to do that when we're in the middle of that thing, just like the children of Israel for 400 years in Egypt being persecuted as slaves. And whatever the situation that you're finding yourself in, do not let that convince you that God is no longer cares about you, or he's not interested in your life, that he doesn't have a plan. And thirdly, I think the thing that hit me the most is just studying and looking at the character of God and how holy and huge and just, like I already mentioned, unequal he is to us. And we already talked about how it's easy to make God into a version of ourselves. And it's easy to get into a ditch of either God is just out there and he's just powerful and he makes creation and he doesn't care about me, and that's fine, I'll do my thing and he does his thing. Maybe we wouldn't say that, but it's easy to think subconsciously maybe like that or live our lives like that. Or to think that God is our buddy and just whatever I want to ask him, yeah, he'll do it. God is neither one of those things. God is not our buddy. He's not someone that we can just ask whatever we feel like and, yeah, he'll give it to us because he's nice. That is not God, but he's also not out there and distant and not caring about us. God is present. He is very involved in our lives, and he's shaping our lives in ways that we have no idea that he is. And yet he is also separate from us, and he is holy, and he is much greater than us and not our equal. And so when we approach him, let's consider that, and also consider the sacrifice that Jesus had to make so that that's possible, that we can't even approach him. And I think as you look around, you see creation, you see the just the majesty that God created and stuff, let that point you back to God and to a place of worship. I'd like to end with reading part of a song written by Billy and Cindy Foote. It was sung by Phillips Craig and Dean. It says, "You are God alone." The title is "You Are God Alone." It says, "You are not a God created by human hands. You are not a God dependent on any mortal man. You are not a God in need of anything we can give. By your plan, that's just the way it is. You're the only God whose power none can contend. You're the only God whose name and praise will never end. You're the only God who's worthy of everything we can give. You're God, and that's just the way it is. You are God alone from before time began. You are on your throne, and you are God alone. And right now, in the good times and bad, you are on your throne, and you are God alone." Let's remember that as we interact with God, as we read his word. No matter how familiar we become with his word and the teachings that he gave us, let's have that awe of him and respect him. And if he asks you to do something, don't come up with 5 or 6 objections to it first. Just do it. Amen.